Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. We're experts in ecologically friendly lab-grown diamonds. Mention code RADIO10 for 10% off. That's cleanorigin.com, online or one of our retail stores.
When you hear people discussing rising water levels, you probably only think of sea level rise, but what about lake level rise? Today's guest is Deanna Epps, a physical scientist with the Detroit District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. She analyzes and forecasts water levels in the Great Lakes and produces weekly and monthly forecasts. As the region continues experiencing record water levels, we'll ask her about the factors at play and how local agencies are working to mitigate impacts like coastal flooding and erosion. Let's dive into it. Deanna, thank you for joining us on the Weather Geeks podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to read some of your background because though you're working with water levels, she's a card-carrying weather geek. She's got a bachelor's degree in meteorology from Oswego State University and a master's degree in geography from Michigan State University. So I'm sure she knows my friend and colleague, Julie Winkler, a physical scientist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and her work focuses on Great Lakes water level forecasting. She's also a member of the International Association for the Great Lakes Research. Okay, here comes the question that I ask all Weather Geeks guests. How'd you become a weather geek? How'd you become interested in weather and meteorology?
Weather geeks per se. It was a storm. It was a Labor Day storm of 1998. I grew up in Syracuse, New York, and it was a derecho that moved through when I was young. You know, I was about 6-7 years old. And that kind of piqued my interest, and I got a weather workbook for Christmas in second grade, and from then on, it was all about meteorology, and, from then on, I just wanted to be a meteorologist, so.
And did you all hear something that she said? Let me do a little myth dispelling here. She said derecho. So they didn't just appear 5 years ago or 2 years ago. They've been around. I know they've been in the media a lot more, and some people aren't as familiar with what they are. I get from time to time, or is this derecho, something new? But there are these, large scale sort of wind storms that move over large distances related to outflow from storms. So it's one of those cases where, even in 2020, we saw a record breaking derecho in parts of Iowa and the Midwest and Great Plains. So it's interesting because oftentimes on this show, it's a tornado or it's a hurricane or a big snowstorm. But I think you're our first derecho inspired meteorologist. Wow. Welcome to Weather Geeks history here. But in all seriousness, how did you, and again, you have a meteorology degree, and I resonate with your background because I have all meteorology degrees, but I actually am a professor at the University of Georgia in the Department of Geography. So I have a similar background to yours. So how did you migrate from meteorology into geography and why? And then how did you end up doing water level forecasting?
Yeah, it's a very interesting path. When I graduated from Oswego State, there was just an opportunity that kind of got lucky and fell in my lap there at Michigan State and, got me into the geography department. And there at the geography department at Michigan State, they have a climate and hydrology focused part of that program. Like, as you mentioned, Dr. Julie Winkler is, staff member there. And I worked with Dr. Li Feng Lo while I was there. That's when I kind of started to dabble in a little bit of the hydrology world and climate. I got a little bit more background in climatology. So that's kind of what set me up to transition into this more hydrology role with the Corps. I've definitely learned a lot on the job, but I find myself, using a lot that I learned in meteorology. It's, when you're forecasting Great Lakes water levels, it's really almost applied meteorology and understanding how these water levels go up and down based on the hydrologic and meteorological conditions that are occurring.
Yeah, and I know several good people up there in at Michigan State, and just an opportunity for the note that much of the great climate and sort of hydroclimatological work that goes on in universities around the country are in geography departments. There's a lot of synergy and connection between meteorology. Geography is not maps and capitals and things that people think geography is. It's human geography and physical geography and geomorphology and climate and a lot of other things. So I want to dispel that myth as well. Again, I'm a meteorologist, but we have an atmospheric sciences program in geography also at the department at University of Georgia. And so over the 15 years that I've been in that department after coming from NASA, I'm amazed at how people really don't understand what the discipline of geography is, because they just know what it is from like elementary school when they're doing capitals and rivers and things like that. I want to kind of pivot now to your work at the U.S. Army Corps. And shout out, by the way, to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, a great agency, I believe within the military. But the reason I know this is because I actually have a project right now at UGA with several colleagues, with Todd Bridges and some folks down here more in the southern part of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Water levels in the Great Lakes definitely rise and fall throughout the year. It's a natural process, as they often tell us climate scientists about climate change things. When do they typically rise and when do they typically fall? Let's just get into some basics of water level.
Yeah, so water levels, as you mentioned, you know, they fluctuate seasonally. Right now in the winter time is about when we are at what we call their seasonal low. As we get into the springtime and you start to see snow melt and increased spring precipitation and runoff, that's when we typically see water levels rise in the Great Lakes. As we get into the early to mid-summer months, that's when we start to, you know, they start to reach their peak water level. And then typically in the fall and early winter, that's typically when we see their decline. And the reason for that is that, you know, over the summer months, the lake water is warm. And once we get into the fall, we start to have that colder air moving over the warmer lake surfaces. And that's really what induces evaporation. And evaporation off of the lakes is really the primary water level decline in these fall and early winter months.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. This evaporation is sort of, there's an example of coupling to the atmosphere. As we know, that water leaves the lake and it goes into the atmosphere as well. Really fascinating. I'm talking with Deanna Apps, who is with the Detroit District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, talking all things lake level and water level, and not just sea level. We're talking lakes. Is there a particular Great Lake, given that you're in that region, that experiences or has experienced in recent years or decades more water level rise or fluctuation than others?
You know, it's really, really these last couple years, we've really seen strong water level rises, especially the wet springs of 2017 and 2019 really saw large rises on pretty much all of the lakes. You know, from Superior to Ontario. And then, you know, recently, I think a lot of people are aware that, you know, we've been at record high water levels on some of the lakes really over the last couple years. And, you know, a lot of that owing to some of these wet conditions. And, you know, really those two time periods, the rise and the decline period, so the rise in the spring, the decline during the fall, you know, weather conditions are really during those two times of the years can have really strong impacts you know, on that whole year. You know, for example, Lake Michigan Huron last year, and you'll hear me say Lake Michigan Huron as one lake, because the lake is connected at the Straits of Mackinac, hydraulically we consider that they rise and fall together. So if you hear me say Lake Michigan Huron, you know, that's the reference there. But Lake Michigan Huron last fall, the conditions were just so wet that it really had a lack of a seasonal decline in that 2019. And that really set us up for some of the record highs we saw in that lake this year in 2020.
Yeah, that really interesting. And I know that we've had some record or warmer than average winter temperatures. Does that affect lake levels at all, given what you just said about evaporation?
Yeah, the temperature during the, especially the early winter when there's potential for evaporation to still occur off of the lakes. So that can play a big part. If we have like similar as to actually what we saw last year and we've seen kind of so far this year in December, where when you have those warmer than normal temperatures, in the region, that temperature difference now between the air and the water is less. And so you don't get as much evaporation off of the lakes, which can hinder the decline.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, understanding sort of evaporation, you know, we ought to get into specific heat and heat capacity, because as folks know, water tends to have a higher specific heat. Well, maybe you know this. And so that's why it tends to warm and cool more slowly than the land. You know, why wouldn't you go to the beach down here in the South in Florida and Georgia, perhaps in May, even though the air temperature is starting to be a little hot, that water's still cold. And so I'm sure those kind of thermodynamic and thermal effects are at play in the lakes as well, but just from a different perspective, which takes me to my next kind of curiosity question for you. How does sort of the presence of ice or lack thereof affect water level rise or fluctuations?
Yeah, ice is a tricky one because, you know, it does impact the evaporation and it doesn't impact water temperatures as well. So, you know, typically, you know, if you're experiencing a cold winter where you see a significant amount of ice cover form, you'll probably get significant evaporation because of with the ice cover formation. And that can, however, it can lead to water temperatures that are much cooler. So as we go throughout the year, there have been studies done that show the following fall, there could be less evaporation because those water temperatures are cooler. So there have been studies that have looked into that. Now, if you have more of an ice-free lake, that becomes a little bit more challenging, too, because although the potential for evaporation does still exist because the lake is open, doesn't mean that it's going to occur. You know, if we get those warmer than normal temperatures, you know, there might not be, you know, much evaporation.
Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. Founded by a leading family in the diamond industry for more than a century, we're experts in lab-grown diamonds because that's all we do. Clean Origin, the only diamond jewelers who give you a 100-day, no-questions-asked return on your purchase. Head to cleanorigin.com or one of our retail stores and mention code RADIO10 for an additional 10% off your purchase. That's cleanorigin.com, code RADIO10.
And we are back on the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia. I'm speaking with Deanna Apps from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers about lake levels and lots of interesting sort of hydrological and water and meteorological interactions. So we're going to geek out today. That's what we do on this podcast. We're going to geek out. So I want to kind of pivot now, Deanna, to something that you worked on in 2019. You presented at the International Association for Great Lakes Research Conference, which focused on extreme events in Great Lakes. And I guess in the past decade or so, and I think maybe you mentioned this, the Great Lakes have seen record low levels to near record high levels in a short period of time. What is considered to be an extreme event? What does that mean, an extreme event? And how do these events affect the water levels in the Great Lakes?
Yeah, so we at the Corps, we have a fairly about a little over 100 year period of record of water levels across the lakes. And this is monthly mean water levels. So our data sets go back to 1918. For all the Great Lakes. And, you know, in that period of record, you know, we've seen periods of both high and low water. So, you know, when we say have reached record highs, we would typically refer to that as like a monthly record high. So, you know, over these last few years where we've seen these, you know, wet conditions, you know, meteorological conditions and hydrologic conditions in the basin, we've seen these monthly record highs occurring for various months, you know, throughout these last couple years on the lakes. And so that's how, you know, we determine what, you know, that record or extreme is, just, you know, like I said, based on that period of record back to 1918 and using monthly mean water levels.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. And we're talking with Deanna Apps from the Army Corps, and just really fascinating topic here. That's one of the reasons I love hosting Weather Geeks, and I hope you love listening to it, is because, you know, this is an area where I'm learning things just like you listening right now. So it's just really an honor to be able to talk to you. The next line of questioning, or the next road that I want to go down is related to El Nino. And before we, you know, get into El Nino, let me just sort of remind the listeners, and some listeners know exactly what El Nino is, and others may be like, yeah, I've heard of that, and I know it affects our weather here in the U.S., but I don't know if I really recall what it is. But, you know, every 2 to 7 years or so, the eastern to central Pacific ocean waters warm. They're anomalously warmer, and that happens due to some very interesting interactions between the ocean and the atmosphere, and it causes changes in the atmospheric patterns too, and jet streams and so forth, which cause changes far from the eastern and central Pacific. The cold phase of that, or the cold anomaly of that, is called La Niña. Is there any evidence that the El Niño or the ENSO cycle, the El Niño Southern Oscillation is what I mean by ENSO, that has any predictability for lake levels where in your region?
Yeah, so there have been, you know, some studies done in the Great Lakes region on ENSO and even other teleconnections as well. The difficult part I find is a challenge in the Great Lakes Basin is just even the difference you'll get in conditions between the Lake Superior Basin and the Lake Ontario Basin. So where, you know, the Lake Superior Basin may be, you know, more impacted by, you know, cold air plunging in from the north during a La Niña may not impact the Lake Ontario Basin. So it's hard to really make general assumptions about La Niña or El Niño really for the whole basin, which makes it a challenge. It's definitely something that we look at, you know, with the La Niña, you know, occurring or, you know, ongoing and, you know, looking to last through this winter. It's something that, you know, we keep an eye on. And as far as, you know, what that could mean for some colder temperatures in the region or wetter conditions in the region. But it's just, I feel like the variability is just makes it very difficult to make a strong linkage to how that impacts lake levels.
And you heard Deanna mention other teleconnections, because there are all kinds of other alphabet soup things that we talk about in meteorology and climatology, like the Arctic Oscillation and the North Atlantic Oscillation, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, the PDO, AO, NAO. So when you hear scientists talk about these terms, there are these interesting sort of teleconnection type patterns that we see that are naturally varying that can have impacts far from their origin, which is where that word teleconnection comes from. Now, I want to sort of get more into the so what about why the Army Corps cares about lake levels. And we'll dive into that a bit more later in the podcast. But I know that there are homes along the coastal regions there and built communities and so forth. What are the impacts that these communities are experiencing, if any, from some of the lake level changes that you observe or monitor?
Yeah, the impacts across the Great Lakes in 2019 is 2020 has been pretty impactful. In pretty severe in certain regions. A lot of it, you know, depends on, for example, the wind. You know, a lot of storms moving through when the lake level is already high, and then you have a strong storm system. Let's say with, you know, strong, westerly winds moving across, you know, Lake Michigan or Lake Erie, that can really build up water on certain sides of the lake, make wave impacts more severe that can cause shoreline erosion, coastal flooding. A lot of these issues we've seen throughout the, you know, really, like I said, throughout the Great Lakes over these last few years with dealing with high water, property damage. There's been a number of things, you know, that have occurred. I know that there's been pictures of, you know, houses falling into Lake Michigan. The impacts have been quite severe at times, especially when, you know, these water level records are occurring sometimes in the spring and early summer months when, you know, that's when we're at some of the highest, you know, water levels in the system. And it's just created, some really challenging times for people and businesses that are on the shores of the Great Lakes.
Yeah, and I want to kind of dig into some of the so what aspects a bit later in the podcast. But before we do that, I want to sort of pause here. And because again, I think listeners listen to Weather Geeks, they get exposure to so many different people and their organizations. I think people generally have heard of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that may not exactly know what the agency does. Can you give us a little 101 just on who you are as the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, what your mission is, or just your broad goals?
Yeah, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers really has a wide array of missions. I'd say in the Detroit district, you know, the Great Lakes water level mission is quite unique to our region, where, you know, a lot of projects in the Army Corps of Engineers, you know, are, you know, some could be ecosystem related. You know, a lot of ones in the Detroit district are navigation based, you know, keeping navigation moving through, you know, the Great Lakes. You know, maybe people have realized, you know, the alternate care facility mission that was done by the Corps of Engineers this past, you know, spring with COVID. So they really, you know, are, you know, dabble in many different areas, and just to really help, you know, how we can help and assist people that, you know, need help in our nation.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
And we are back on the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia, and I'm speaking with Deanna Apps from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And I did mention earlier, so I want to give a big shout out to Todd Bridges and Ryan Bledsoe of the Institute for Resilient Infrastructure Systems at UGA, because one of the projects we're working on down here with the University of Georgia and various Army Corps partners is related to engineering with nature solutions in parts of our region here. So I'm becoming more familiar with the types of things that the Army Corps does. I mean, there's a large mission, and I invite our listeners to, you know, Google and search if you want to know a little bit more, because there's a lot of good information and some really good projects that the Army Corps of Engineers, I consider them one of the agencies and one of the organizations within our federal government that, you know, perhaps may not be as visible as some other agencies, but are doing things that affect our lives and are importantly every day. So thank you and your colleagues for what you do. I want to kind of stay in the sort of so what realm of the discussion. Some shoreline landowners are requesting seawalls and retaining walls to be built to prevent property damage. Is this a sustainable solution from your perspective? And are there any issues with these seawalls or retaining walls?
So, you know, a lot of this really is dealt with in our regulatory office. You know, I should explain, our regulatory office is the one that helps issue permits. So if you're, you know, a shoreline property owner, if you want to construct, you know, something on your property, such as a seawall that, you know, would impact, you know, the lake, and you need a permit for that. So, you know, these seawalls, you know, I see them more as, you know, a temporary solution, really. It's going to, you know, provide you, you know, maybe what you need from the water level rising, and it could protect you from that. But there also are long-term effects to the overall, you know, ecosystem there along the shoreline when seawalls are built. And so there, you know, as a solution method, you know, this is really, I mean, when you get to high water, it's, you know, there's only so many options that, you know, one has, whether that's building a sandbag wall or employing the, you know, an inflatable flood barrier, you know, the, you know, a seawall potentially, or even, you know, which is, you know, becoming a, you know, probably the most adaptable solution for the future is if you can to move, you know, your property further back, away from the lake. But, you know, it's all really going to be dependent on, you know, where you are on the lake. What is my best course of action? So that's where it really comes down to the homeowners to, you know, to really, you know, look at resources that are available to them, you know, contact, you know, have discussions with contractors and neighbors to really figure out maybe what the best course of action is in their specific area, and then go from there.
Yeah, and this sounds like one of those areas where I appreciate the fact that you mentioned your regulatory people deal with these, because this sounds like one of the murky aspects of your job, sort of dealing with these regulatory issues, and murky, pun intended, by the way. But this really sounds like one of those areas where, as we deal with in science, as a scientist myself, we work in these sort of areas that have interfaces to societal relevance, but sometimes, you know, we try to steer clear of some of those types of things. And so we let the regulatory people and lawyers and so forth handle those. So I really appreciate your answer there. The STORM Act was recently passed, and I don't know what it is, but I've heard of it. What is the STORM Act, and what does it mean for efforts to mitigate rising waters and coastal erosion in your area?
Yeah, I'm aware that, you know, just passed. I still haven't quite figured out all the details with that. And I think we're going to be learning, you know, obviously over these next, you know, months, you know, to figure out what that kind of means for us at the core.
Yeah, so it's really new. And so I think our producers are kind of curious about it too, but we didn't have a lot of information on it. But it sounds like it's still, you're still in a learning curve with it yourself. I kind of want to pivot now to the future. What are some of the advances that you hope to see in water level forecasting? And then I have a follow-up question to that I just thought of as well. But what are some of the things that you hope to see in the area of water forecasting advancement?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the most challenging things about water level forecasting, and it is really, I think, you know, the most challenging, even from, you know, a meteorological forecast standpoint, everybody wants to know what the conditions are going to be in the future. I mean, that's the, you know, million-dollar question. And, you know, we have our forecast that goes out 6 months. And so right now we're getting into that time period where we're forecasting into the, springtime and early summer. But, you know, especially when you're at high water and folks are dealing with high water, sometimes people want to know, okay, well, what does that mean longer than 6 months? You know, can we expect the same high water next year or the year after? And so I think, you know, when I got to the core a few years ago, I was just, you know, really learning, you know, how this forecast process works and, you know, learning about water levels. And really, I think one of the goals for myself is at the core and just as a, you know, in my career is to really be able to use, weather and climate forecasts to really help understand how water levels change and could change going into the future and have a more clear picture. And I don't know if we ever will because of just how variable the lakes are and the different variables that impact it at different times of the year. But I feel like that's kind of pie in the sky for me is really trying to use weather and climate forecasts to understand what lake levels could be in the future.
And you talk about forecasts, as you well know, as a meteorologist yourself, we use various observations in situ, remote sensing, satellite radar and so forth, and models, computer models and so forth. And I imagine you use a lot of those types of tools as well in the forecasting. Are there, and this is just, if you had a magic wand and you were sort of the had all the budget you need, which we know in the real world, that's never the case. But if there's something that you just wish you could have to make your job better from a technical or an observational or a modeling standpoint, is there something that comes to mind, kind of a first order thing that comes to mind for you?
The very first thing that comes to mind, and it probably the biggest challenge that we have when hydroclimate scientists looking at this, is the challenge of the international border. You know, we can't just grab one data set because it might not cover Canada or it might just cover the U.S. And that's something is which we have a what's called the coordinating committee of the, you know, the Great Lakes, really. It brings hydrologists and, engineers from both sides of the border together. And we kind of hash out these issues, you know, throughout the year. And I'd say that there has been, especially been progress in recent years and making more, as you would say, maybe merge data sets that can help us resolve some of these issues. But, you know, even from like a climate forecast perspective, it's like every month I'm going to the Climate Prediction Center and I'm going to Environment and Climate Change Canada's website because I'm trying to get both to see if they're similar, if they're different, and kind of, you know, kind of just hashing out some of those disparities between the borders.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because I recall some people that I guess clearly didn't understand that we have borders and different data sets during the wildfires last year, because there were some people out there saying, see, they're lying about the fires. They stop at the border. I thought that was a little funny, because it was just the fact that it depends on whose data set you're using and what you plot on a map. And unfortunately, a lot of people perhaps don't understand that the, you know, is not sort of universal. Different people own it. There are different formats and all kinds of challenges in working with data. So again, this is the type of thing that I love when scientists like you explain those things to the public, because they just see maps and just see fires in the United States only and say, there's no fires in Canada. Well, there are. That was just the U.S. data set being used. But I want to kind of sort of start to pivot to a close here. You're a meteorologist that's working in an area that I would consider perhaps somewhat non-traditional to many students that, for example, come into my meteorology program at the University of Georgia. They probably have this sort of narrow suite of job opportunities in their mind. And frankly, one of them may not be the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Give some advice to a young student out there that may be thinking about future jobs in this atmospheric sciences and meteorology, and how you sort of, what your experiences were as you navigated into an area that perhaps wasn't obvious as a meteorological landing spot for your career, but it sounds like you're doing quite well and are happy there.
Yeah, you know, for me, I feel pretty lucky because I somehow found my way to this. But I guess, you know, my biggest advice is you know, take as many opportunities that, you know, that you can, and don't be afraid to, you know, explore areas, you know, that, you know, maybe aren't at the top of your list. I never thought I would be focusing on like hydrology related topics. But, you know, if you have a chance to take an elective, you know, take something maybe a little bit more out of your comfort zone that can lead you to somewhere else. You know, had I not had the background I had at Michigan State, I probably wouldn't have, you know, ended up at the Corps, because I needed a little bit of hydrology background for this position. So, you know, I just, you know, don't shut yourself off. Even if you really know you want to be in forecasting or something like that, you know, I just think, you know, explore, you know, other classes that maybe are a little outside of your comfort zone, and you might find something that you really enjoy.
And I would add to that, as a professor, definitely check out any internships that are out there and summer research opportunities as well, because it is, even though you have these core things that you're interested in, as Deanna talks about, it never hurts to get exposure in other areas, whether it's hydrology or GIS or a different type of skill set. Where can people find more information? Do you have websites, or are you on social media somewhere, or your projects or water level monitoring? Are there any sort of social media or internet sites you can let us know about?
Yeah, so the Detroit District at the Army Corps of Engineers, we have a webpage. And if you were to Google Great Lakes Water Levels Detroit District, you'd pretty much, you'd make it there. The Detroit District also is on like Facebook. In fact, a lot of the districts, not just the Detroit District, is on there. So you could find the district in your area. You know, we partner closely with like the Chicago District, the Buffalo District as well. So there's, you know, there's just many, and even like the headquarters USACE, I believe they have like a Facebook page, and usually each district has a website as well. But if you're looking for really the water level information, I mean, there's a, you know, a long web address, but really if you just Google, you know, Great Lakes Water Levels, you know, Detroit District, you'll end up on our page. And I gotta say, there's a lot of, you know, especially if you're, you know, a weather geek, and there's a lot of great information on there. I mean, we talk about precipitation and evaporation and runoff and trends we've seen in the data, and there's precipitation data and water level data. So it's much more than just water levels that are on there. We talk about basin conditions. So, you know, we do a write-up every month about, you know, the conditions that each of the lake basins is experiencing. You know, between precipitation or runoff, evaporation, we talk about those things. So, you know, there's a little bit more than just the water levels that are on there.
And I think that's where we have to end it. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, Deanna. But before I go, it's time for our Geek of the Week. We like to highlight a scientist superstar, a great geologist, or a weather weenie at the end of every podcast. This episode's Geek of the Week is Melissa Griffin. Melissa is an assistant state climatologist at the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources. She loves the STEM outreach and education side of the weather and enjoys conducting weather-related experiments with teachers and students of all ages. Melissa also shares unique facts about the climate and weather events for South Carolina with her On This Day post on Twitter at MLGRIFFINWX1. That's at MLGriffinWX1. Keep it up, Melissa. And if you know someone that's deserving of our Geek of the Week, please check out our social media pages. Deanna, thank you so much for joining us on the Weather Geeks podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia, and we will talk to you and geek out the next time. Take care, everyone.